You're listening to Conversations on Strategy. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the authors and are not necessarily those of the Department of the Army, the U.S. Army War College, or any other agency of the U.S. government.
Today I'm talking with Dr. Luke P. Balocki, Major Jamie Critelli, and Captain Gustavo Ferreira. Balocki is the author of The Strategic Importance of Taiwan to the United States and its Allies, Parts 1 and 2, which were published in the summer and autumn 2023 issues of Parameters. Balocki is an associate professor of practice at the National Defense University. Ferreira and Critelli are authors of Taiwan's Food Resiliency or Not in a Conflict with China, which was published in the summer 2023 issue of Parameters. They also wrote China's Global Monopoly on Rare Earth Elements, which was published in the spring 2022 issue of Parameters. Ferreira is a senior agricultural economist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture and serves as an agricultural officer at the 353rd Civil Affairs Command, U.S. Army Reserves. Critelli, U.S. Army Reserves, is a civil affairs officer serving as an agricultural officer in the 353rd Civil Affairs Command. He is a seasonal farm business owner. Luke, why don't you start us off, please?
I read Jamie and Gustavo's article on food security for Taiwan. I found it very interesting. I'd like to throw out some questions for you, Jamie, if you don't mind. After reading your article, I was thinking, given Taiwan may only have 6 months of food reserves in the event of a conflict with or blockade with China, which is a major concern of the national security establishment these days, and given the fact that the U.S.-Taiwan Relations Act declares that any kind of blockade or boycott is a grave concern to the United States, do you foresee a Berlin airlift situation for allies and partners to resupply Taiwan in the event of a blockade? Or will maritime blockade running be the only solution that's foreseen?
Luke, I think the answer is actually neither of the above, but I do have to give just a tiny bit of background. The reality is, due to over-reliance on imports, the scale of this situation in the event of a blockade or an invasion will quickly become dire. Now, it doesn't require an invasion, but just a blockade. With the number of ships and aircraft the PLA has, it would be very, very difficult to get in or out. I want to also just give some color to this through a couple different scenarios. The first would be, if we just look at what Taiwan imports today, let's look at one commodity, let's say soy. Soy is the one grain that it imports in the lowest quantity, but it still requires 2.6 million metric tons a year. In terms of a Berlin airlift type scenario, that means that you need about 27,000 C5 sorties in a year to bring in just that one grain. If you're talking about running a blockade, you're talking about requiring almost 50 Panamax-sized vessels with shipping containers loaded with that grain coming into a port, and of course, having a port available to unload that from. If we look a little more in detail, if we were talking about just feeding the military, that would be one MRE per day minimum. With a full reserve call-up, that's almost 2 million soldiers. That's 15,000 cases of MREs a day, or 3,200 pallets, or 100 shipping containers. 3.6 million pounds. Again, it's just not possible with aircraft.
Yeah, it sounds like a dire situation for sure. We're not talking about half a city. It is some 25 million people that live on Taiwan. If they were to prioritize stockpiling foods before a blockade scenario, what kind of foods would you recommend that they start to stockpile?
What would have to happen in the case of Taiwan is to start to shift away from the gross import of feed grains to feed cattle, chicken, and fish, as they do today, and more towards staples for human consumption, things with a much longer shelf life. When we looked at the projection, rice is the one grain that Taiwan seems to have enough of. They seem to have about 9 months on hand. Other commodities are much less. I would advocate for things such as dairy, like dry milk powders, baby formulas, other forms of stabilized protein sources. In other words, we have to completely reshuffle to meet human needs instead of feeding livestock. When you look at the different animal types that are out there, a fish is about 1 pound of grain can translate into almost 1 pound of protein. A chicken is about 1.5 pounds of grain into 1 pound of protein. Beef, cattle, and pigs are much more inefficient, somewhere in the order of 8 to 10 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of protein. So we need to drastically rethink that supply chain and what we bring in.
In your article, you talked about Victory Garden, which was a program in the U.S. during both World Wars where we were rejiggering our agricultural programs to prepare for self-sufficiency. How can Taiwan do something similar?
Taiwan could do something very similar to Victory Gardening, but there's been quite a few developments over the last few decades. And I think Taiwan is probably best positioned to make best use of a program such as this. Aside from grain, the nation of Taiwan could satisfy the full need for vegetables through a sort of victory gardening. There's local decentralized community gardens that could be used. There's hydroponics, what I'm also calling closet husbandry, growing things inside of apartments and residences. And then there's like a stretch target there for re-looking at how they do aquaculture today. The reality is hydroponics as a part of this program has evolved to the point that anybody with the right know-how, equipment, and preparation could satisfy close to 100% of their needs within whatever living space they occupy. And this is due to advances in the light sources, as well as the trays that are used and how they're hooked up. There are some risks, however, and it's something I'm sure that the Taiwanese government is keenly aware of. They need stable electricity supplies and a source of available water and nutrients. So if the power goes down and there's no water, if there's no ability to bring in commercial fertilizers, this may fall flat. A stretch target, though, I'm saying, is revamping how they use their existing aquaponic infrastructure. Taiwan is one of the leading aquaponic producers in the world. They could offset any sort of protein sources which are lost due to a blockade with onshore aquaponics. With the amount of automation that Taiwan has, they could fully digitize this. They could also go and revamp their sewage treatment plants in such a way that they could produce algae out of that and then digest the algae in a way to make it pure and then use that as a novel feedstock for the fish. One thing I just want to add as a caveat is just that during COVID, Taiwan improved their food self-sufficiency by 5%. By starting to implement all of these victory gardening methods that I mentioned. And this was because there was a perceived mistrust of the government and what their food stocks looked like.
Everyone had supply chain concerns during COVID, but Taiwan especially. They have 4 nuclear reactors, but I think they're aging and there is a pretty strong green movement in Taiwan that's resistant to reliance on nuclear power. It would seem like an ideal place to develop something like thermogenic sources of power. But maybe we'll leave that for another article.
Gus, I have a few questions for you. Should the U.S. develop a strategic reserve of rare earth materials, much like we have for strategic oil reserves today?
Thank you. This question, we're kind of shifting towards our other line of research, which look into the current global dominance that China has on this particular sector. The short answer is a qualified yes. And this is because the U.S. has already a mechanism in place to deal with this. However, it may not be sufficient in its current form. And I'll give a little bit more detail. Back in 1939, right before World War II started, the U.S. created what we call the National Defense Stockpile, which has a statutory purpose of stockpiling strategic and critical materials in order to, I'm going to quote, to decrease and to preclude, when possible, a dangerous and costly dependence by the United States upon foreign sources, or a single point of failure for supplies of such materials in times of national emergency. So as a result today, the Pentagon now stockpiles about 42 different raw materials to include rare earth elements. They're needed for manufacturing a long range of defense items, from ships to ammunition. The thing is, while these stockpiles do constitute an important insurance policy against any possible disruptions to the supply chain, some experts, they argue that they are insufficient, especially in the context of a war against China. There are 3 factors that support this argument. First of all, the U.S. lacks mining and refining capacity of some of this critical mineral. They still rely greatly on imports. Second, in a war against China, the U.S. military will most likely use weapons systems and munitions that contain these critical minerals at unprecedented rates. Let's just think about what we've seen in the war in Ukraine that is showing us how high-intensity conflict reduces stockpiles more quickly than they can be replenished. This is a problem we are facing and our NATO partners are facing as well. even Russia is facing, had to resort to unconventional suppliers such as North Korea. Third, U.S. current mineral stockpile levels are far lower than those in China. They have their own strategic reserves. They're at a higher level than us, which will put us in a disadvantaged position. So as a result of all this, some experts argue that the national defense stockpile should increase their levels of stockpiles of these critical minerals to sustain at least 3 years of domestic demand. We do have a mechanism and some reserves in place that somehow mimic what we have with our strategic oil reserves. However, some pundits think the current levels are not sufficient for worst case scenario.
Thank you for that insight, Gus. I was looking through some of the other research that you had done, and it was quoting a number for one of the leading jet fighters that's produced by NATO, requiring somewhere on the order of 400 kilograms of rare earth elements for just one fighter. So when you say things like upping the stockpile to cover 3 years of demand, it puts it into a lot of perspective. My next question is just around making this rare earth material processing come full circle. One of the recommendations was around implementing a recycling program for these. Could you talk to us a little bit about that and tell us what that would look like?
Currently, the quantity of recycled rare earth elements remain very limited and typically originates from the extraction of these materials out of different products such as battery, permanent magnets, and fluorescent lamps. However, expanding this recycling program using a market-based approach comes with its own set of challenges. This is because China can use and has used its market power to manipulate global prices of rare earth elements in a way that simply discourages further development of recycling sectors. So they have the ability to dump large supplies at the market at a specific time, which will lower the price, which will take a lot of the incentives for an emerging recycling program sector. In addition, there's also a whole set of logistical and technical complexities they also get in the way. Those include an initial high setup costs and a long list of negative environmental impacts associated with recycling programs, which in Western countries, that tends to be a pretty major obstacle that the industry will have to surpass. Nevertheless, there are ongoing federal support efforts in the U.S. to increase the reuse and recycle rare earth elements. Those are codified in policy, executive orders from two administrations, Mr. Trump and Mr. Biden administrations. One example of such initiative is the recent Strategic Materials Recovery and Reuse Program, which authorized the recovery of these critical minerals from federal agency end-of-life scrap and excess equipment. Think about night vision goggles or Bradley fighting vehicle storage windows. So if there is materials that can be recovered, there's a program in place that will be able to extract those pieces of equipment. Nevertheless, this is the cautionary tale here. This recycling program should not be regarded as a viable single solution to this problem. We should look at them as a complement policy or just another tool in the toolbox that's going to go along with many other policy options.
My final question is a little lengthy, so bear with me. In a conflict between Taiwan and China, where the U.S. and its allies are likely to be involved, what do you think a blockade embargo scenario would look like? Would it involve China halting exports of all rare earth materials to the U.S. and Japan? Or would it be the U.S. and Japan having to look at the risk of running a blockade to ensure food and other supplies by air or sea? I'm worried that such a confrontation would include the stoppage of rare earth materials and those exports out of China, which could then likely lead to a world economic meltdown, much like we saw during the COVID supply chain. What are your thoughts on this?
This is a plausible scenario that's being taken into account by the White House. Last year, the White House released a first-of-its-kind supply chain assessment that found that our over-reliance on foreign sources coming from adversarial nations, and specifically for critical minerals, poses a national and economic security threat. Unfortunately, this is not something that we should discount because we have seen the short-term consequence of Beijing weaponizing its dominance in the rare earth market when in 2010, China stopped all shipments of rare earth elements to Japan for nearly 2 months. Despite being a relatively short disruption, it had really serious negative consequences on Japan's automotive industry and other sectors as well. It also led to global price spikes of these elements, but also out of the scare, it generated a global rush to secure supplies. Multiple nations were trying to scramble and find whatever supplies they could right after China took this measure. The problem is because the ubiquitous presence of rare earth in so many supply chains, it's easy to foresee the severe economic consequence of a longer-term Chinese export ban of these elements, which would likely cripple production of many consumer products and weapon systems, both in the U.S. and some of our strategic partners. However, on the other side of the coin, a prolonged market disruption will also accelerate global efforts to break this dependency on China or rare earth elements, which you already seen some of those efforts unfolding. I like to kind of point out to a recent example of such market reaction. So when we think about what happened to the global food markets after Russia invaded Ukraine, we had Russia, Belarus, and China stopping exporting agriculture fertilizers following the invasion. Because these three nations together are global leaders in this type of agriculture inputs. And one example is potash. There was a surge in global price for these fertilizers. There was some anxieties, markets scrambling. However, in less than a year, markets adjusted. And some of the main important countries, such as Brazil, which is an agriculture powerhouse, found alternative suppliers. Or they reduced their use of those fertilizers. Or they found alternative inputs. As a result, prices stabilized and they've been gradually declining to the pre-war levels. So you see how the markets after the initial shock reacted. So there's some lessons learned of what could happen if China embarks in a similar strategy with rare earth elements. Lastly, this one thing, it's a lot of imports of rare earth happen already in the form of finished products, such as magnets. Those magnets and those other refined products are actually manufactured in China. In that context, if China decides to ban those exports, it will entail significant economic costs for China because it will directly impact its own thriving industry. With all these arguments presented here, a blockade or export ban on China, it's unclear whether time will be on Beijing's side or not. In the longer term, this will actually backfire and allow the West to react to the ban.
I know that you had some questions for Luke about some of his research as well, so I'll turn it over to you.
We got a chance to read your two articles on Taiwan. Extremely informative. Very interesting to see the historical perspective, all the different players in this region, and how this area involves so many other players other than just U.S., Taiwan, and China. It's a much broader discussion here. One thing I'd like to ask you, in the event there's a naval blockade to Taiwan by the Chinese Navy that will disrupt a significant share of the world trade and will have really vast visible negative impacts on key technological sectors that are depending on Taiwan's semiconductor industry. In that context, how do you think the international community will react to the scenario and how far do you think they will go in pressuring China to restore normal maritime commerce in the region?
I touch on it in my article, but it really is something an economist like you should look at more carefully. Of note is that the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, justified not long ago that any such blockade scenario where ships had to divert around Taiwan and not go through the strait would cost the world economy over $1 trillion per annum. It would look like COVID all over again. Supply chains would be disrupted. Not to mention the fact that Taiwan produces the most sophisticated semiconductors in the world. So all the top-level equipment, cars, laptops, cell phones, everything like that, obviously disrupted for quite some time to come. The national security strategy in the United States came out last year, calls for Europe to take a bigger part in ensuring that this sort of scenario doesn't happen. And I think they've reacted very strongly in that direction. The German national security strategy and a bunch of other European countries have all reacted in a way that demonstrates to China that they will take any kind of disruption very, very seriously. I think the IMF still sees the world economy as somewhat recovering from not only COVID, but of course the war in Ukraine and now in Gaza as well. So a third punch in the face to the world economy would be something that could easily push the world economy into a tailspin. And I think the European powers are quite cognizant of that fact. I think there would be quite a lot of pressure on China not to do anything foolish.
It's interesting to see. It's almost like a tale of two economic sectors. So you saw with Ukraine, there's a united front. A lot of it had to do also with just the sheer volume of grain that's produced by Ukraine and the dependency of many countries. Whereas in Taiwan, you mentioned it's in critical strategic production of semiconductors. They will touch the lives of millions of consumers. So it's interesting to see how two different economic sectors had impacts on the global community.
Yeah, for sure. I've noticed, although Ukraine has a bigger population, I think 40 million to some 25 million in Taiwan. Taiwan's economy is, I think, four times as large as Ukraine. So the impact on the world economy would be significant for sure.
The U.S. position has somehow oscillated. That language becomes kind of vague in terms of our commitment to Taiwan. Currently, there's no legal obligation to support the government of Taiwan if attacked by China, as we would do if a NATO partner were attacked by Russia, to invoke Article 5. However, based on the continuous arms sales and policy statements for at least the last two presidents, the United States appears solidly committed to the defense of Taiwan. From your research, how plausible would it be for the United States to get fully involved in the kinetic conflict with China over Taiwan? And if they do it, at what level?
That's a great question and a great mystery, I would say. The U.S. did abrogate its mutual defense treaty with the Republic of China on Taiwan in 1979 as a condition of recognizing the communist government in Beijing. However, they are committed under the Taiwan Relations Act to continue selling arms. I think that various administrations have said and given assurances that there is no end date to supplying those arms as requested. And some would say that selling arms is somewhat of a euphemism for supplying Taiwan with defensive needs, just like they are with Ukraine right now. At least two presidents have said, offhand maybe, but orally in interviews, that we are committed to defending Taiwan, even though we don't have a piece of paper that says that we're obligated to do that. I think the media has kind of sometimes thought that that was a gaffe because there is no such paper, but that doesn't mean that there weren't some sort of secret handshake assurances one way or another. I'm not saying I know there is. I'm just saying, well, the U.S. has a certain interest in the region. I believe the Chinese assume that the U.S. would be involved in any kind of conflict with Taiwan. Given what we just talked about in terms of the world economy's impact of such a conflict, I think that would be a good assumption that we are poised to deter any change in the status quo.
Listeners, you can read the articles at press.armywarcollege.edu/parameters. Luke, Gus, Jamie, what a treat to be able to have this platform and just be a part of this discussion with you. Thank you all so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Stephanie and Gustavo and Jamie, I enjoyed your articles. Happy to work with you anytime on any future projects.
Likewise, thank you for giving us the opportunity to discuss this topic with Luke and everybody else.
For more Army War College podcasts, check out Decisive Point, SSI Live, and A Better Peace.
If you enjoyed this episode and would like to hear more, you can find us on any major podcast platform.